This is a Mentoring Developers podcast, episode number 40. Find us online at mentoringdevelopers.com/episode40. There you can find show notes, highlights, links, and a whole lot more.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hi, everyone. Today's episode, I believe, is going to be one of my favorites. And the reason is that today my guest is somebody who failed over and over, didn't give up, and used the failures and almost failures and turned them into success, an incredible amount of success, to the point that now he's teaching people how to be good managers and how to succeed in management, going up from being a developer up one level to management. And that's pretty interesting. Well, I'm really interested in how he got started and how he almost got fired and he had warnings and he was really messing up in his job. You know what? All of us have gone through these situations where we're not doing what we're expected to do. But it's a fascinating story. I think it will inspire you. And I think that you will enjoy listening to this. And I'm hoping that a lot of you will respond to me and tell me how much it inspired you, or if you had a similar story. Let's hear those stories. Send me emails at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. You can tweet at me at mentoringdevs on the Twitters. And you can also write comments right in the blog post. I'm waiting for all those. And I apologize that sometimes the episodes don't come out on time. Things happen. I just want to make sure that I'm able to give you the right quality and it's going to make your day better. So watch out for this episode, and the next few episodes are going to be really special because I'm going to talk to you about some extra features on the Mentoring Developers podcast and some other things that I'm working on. We're going to talk about this, but for now, let's go listen in on the interview with Marcus. Hi there, dear listeners. You know, I'm always interested in learning about some of the struggles and difficulties that new aspiring software developers and even established software developers face in getting ahead, getting to the next level, finding their dream jobs, or really just being satisfied in their career. And I think that there's a lot we can do as an industry, as seniors, as mentors, to help everybody along. So I was thinking about what's a good set of rules that we can follow to find success. What are maybe the 5-6 different things that you can do consistently? And by doing that, you increase your chances dramatically to succeed. And I thought about it and I wrote some posts on it, some articles. And I think a lot of you can benefit from reading it, and I can benefit from learning from your experiences and see what you think. So if you're somebody that's struggling in finding ways to success, if you're somebody that really wants to know, how do I get from the place that you're at to the next level? How to make more money? How do you become a manager, perhaps? How do you get appreciated? How do you get raises? There are things, there are habits, there are procedures that you can follow that I believe can help you get there. And I want to share that with you. So if you're interested in learning about that, you can sign up to my email list. And in that email list, you will get those emails that will show you exactly how you can get there. I'm sure that you're really going to benefit from it if you're somebody that has questions and you'd like some answers. Also, if you want to get ahead, you will get access to me personally. You could send me emails. The URL for that is mentoringdevelopers.com/list. Head on over to mentoringdevelopers.com/list and sign up. I'll see you there. Hi, everyone. Today, I have Marcus Blankenship with me. Marcus, how are you?
I'm well. Hello. Thanks for having me on.
I'm so excited to have you. You have a great story. And you were about to get fired, and you had warnings after warning after warning, but then you somehow managed to stay on, and then you stayed in that company for a long time. So we want to talk about this story a little bit, but how was it, the feeling? Were you really scared? Were you really apprehensive? Did you doubt yourself during those years?
Oh my gosh. Well, and Arsalan, I wish I could say I'd been treated unfairly or, you know, my boss was a jerk, but he wasn't. It was me. It was all me. And yeah, I was completely scared. I think I was really arrogant at first. I kind of felt like maybe I didn't deserve it. Maybe I was better than that. And they just didn't recognize how good I was. But when I finally understood it and understood that in 2 weeks I was going to be fired if things didn't change, it got my attention. I went out to my car, frankly, and just put my head in my hands and cried because I realized that I was about to screw things up.
Yeah, that's going to be hard for anybody. And we've all been in situations where it's an uncomfortable situation, especially when you're starting out, you're unsure of yourself. You don't know where you stand, and now your dreams are going to be shattered, and you dealt with it. We're going to talk about that, but first let's talk about yourself. Who is Marcus Blankenship?
Marcus Blankenship, oh, what a good question, is an old guy that lives in the desert of Oregon, sort of in the middle of nowhere, and has found the thing he really loves in life at this age is helping developers become great managers, and even helping developers transition from their first promotion into senior developer, and helping experienced managers make those transitions into whether it's department manager or vice president or director or CTO roles. And I find that the transition period that we have is one that was really hard for me personally, for a lot of different reasons, but seems to be a universal problem that it is hard for a lot of people. And so I think it's sort of my mission in life right now to help people make those transitions easier and more confident.
Yeah, I can speak to that. There are lots of people that I know, senior developers, junior developers, they have this dream of just going up through their career and walking up the ladder and getting to a management position, a position where they can actually influence the direction of the company or the organization they're in. So I'm sure that we're going to talk more about this, but I want to see how you got into programming. What was your first encounter?
My first encounter was my parents got a small inheritance when I was 12, and they bought a Commodore VIC-20. They bought it from Sears, of all places, and they put it in front of the large television. We only had one television in the family room, where I lie on my stomach and learn to program BASIC. We didn't have any way to store programs. I think I had a single cartridge game that was Star Trek, but I bought a magazine that had program listings in it, and one of them was a text adventure game. And I typed it all in, took me hours, and debugged it, all the semicolons, all the little weird things about Commodore VIC-20 BASIC. I got it to run, and then I realized I would have to leave the computer running forever if I wanted to keep it around. So that didn't work very well, because that night everyone wanted to watch television and everything got unplugged. And so, that was really my first exposure. I quickly upgraded to, bought my own small television, moved the computer into my room because I was the only one that really liked it, and proceeded to dive into this little 2K device called a Commodore VIC-20. Eventually, I owned a tape drive for it, which I thought was amazing because I could use audio cassette tapes to store the programs that I'd typed in. Upgraded to a Commodore 64 and then an Amiga. And then went on to, was able to go to a local engineering, Oregon Institute of Technology, had a software engineering program. And so that's where I attended college. But I have great fondness for those people out there who remember typing in code and it only ran in memory. You had no way to store it. At least for me, I was too poor to afford the tape drive.
Yeah, those were the days. It's also incredible because the ambition, the typical ambitious program that you wrote was not doing a whole lot. And so it was also small in scope. You were not trying to build a multi-tenant website, or you're not trying to do any real-time communication, there was no way to do any of this communication. There was no internet, so I think it's fascinating that people who grew up with these smaller computers and these memory constrained devices, they learned some of the really low level stuff, right? You're probably doing BASIC. Did you say which programming language it was?
It was BASIC, with a little assembly mixed in, and certainly some peek and poke commands to do register manipulation and stuff.
Yeah, so it's hardcore. So now, between the time that you were tinkering with these devices and the time you went to college, how many years had passed?
I guess it was about six, maybe 8 years. Eight years.
So during that 8 years, did you continue working on software development? Were you interested? Were you reading books? What were you doing?
Yeah, I was continuing to program. I got a paper route. I upgraded my own computer. Like I said, I got an Amiga. I indulged in playing games, but I really enjoyed I felt computers gave me a power and a freedom that I didn't find in my social life and in real life, if you would call it, the ability to control the environment, to feel like I was a master of the domain. Then I actually discovered I got a modem, and my world opened up, because back then, bulletin board systems were very common, and I began dialing all over the globe, which caused my parents no small amount of stress. not only, not so much for the downloading of programs, but primarily for the message boards. And there was a pretty vibrant mid-80s bullet BBS scene that I was a part of. That was sort of had a gray hat layer to it as well. Everyone was really just kind of exploring the boundaries of what these computers could and would do in the future. At one point I became quite poor. I got married and I had to sell my computer. We had a child, and I believe I bought a Data General terminal and had to memorize all the Hayes modem ATDT commands in order to type them in to get the modem to do what I wanted, because it was just a dumb terminal with no operating system. And I used that to connect to all these BBSs. Even though I didn't have a quote-unquote computer, it was a screen, keyboard, and modem put together off of an old Data General Eagle. So long and short of it is, I've always been really excited and nerdy about technical stuff.
That's interesting. That shows your commitment. You're really, really passionate about it. And lots of people are not, and that's okay. A lot of people encounter software development or programming later in life, and they can still succeed. And in today's, you know, availability of technology resources, Google and Stack Overflow and books, there's just so much that you can learn even when you don't have a grounding in that. But it's interesting that you spent so much time doing this. Now, did you think about going to college and studying this as professionally? I mean, going to college and studying software development or computer science?
Yeah, since I was 12, since I got that first VIC-20, I knew that this was going to be my vocation. I'm not sure if I believed I would always get there. I always had a lot of self-doubt, but after I graduated high school and got married and worked at a few jobs, I realized that I wasn't going to get anywhere with what I wanted to do unless I went to college. So I enrolled in the software engineering program at Oregon Tech. We lived 100 miles from the college, and every day I drove 100 miles each way to attend school there. And I would get up at 6 in the morning and drive there, be there around 7:30, attend 8 hours worth of school. I didn't have a computer at home, so I had to use the computers in the lab to do all my homework. And then around 7:30, or between 7:30 and 10 at night, I would turn around and drive home, sleep for a few hours, and do it all again. It was kind of crazy, because looking back, I thought, man, I really must have wanted it. We actually had a local university that had a computer science degree, but it was not a good program, and people coming out of it weren't getting jobs. They were becoming help desk folks, and I wanted to be a software engineer. And so I invested the time it took to go to a school that had the degree that I wanted.
So that's interesting. One of the questions that keeps coming up is, do you really need a degree to become a software developer? And the opinion is divided on that. But you're certainly motivated. Were you motivated by the ability to get a good job, or was it that you thought you needed to get a degree to learn the skills that you needed? Which one was that?
You know, it was actually both. And I'll be honest, I dropped out after 3.5 years because it turns out that working 2 jobs, driving 200 miles a day, and trying to do all your homework, something's got to give. And by the time I reached my junior year, we had 3 children. And so it was pretty obvious that the thing that had to give was school. And I was lucky enough to have gone far enough that I could get an entry-level job programming for a local nonprofit who needed a database system maintained. But when I started, what I realized was a couple things. One, there were people who had spent a tremendous amount of time learning how to teach computer science topics. And I saw a divide between my friends and I who were, we called ourselves sort of pseudo hackers. We would buy a book on C or pointers, or we would buy books and we would try and work through them. But I realized I would never really bridge the gap, I thought, to be a serious engineer unless I got some formal schooling. And of course, by the time I always had my eye on going to get my degree. And in fact, I always wanted to go on to MIT, and that didn't happen, which is just fine now. But once I had kids and needed to support a family, things changed. It became much more practical. So by the time I left college, dropped out and got a job, I was really thankful because I wasn't getting a minimum wage job. I believe I got a job for somewhere around $8 an hour, which was a couple dollars more than minimum wage at the time. So for me, it was twofold. It was the idea of wanting to be serious about and really good at my craft, and also the idea of earning a good wage.
So the degree that you never finished the degree.
Is that true? I wish I could say I did, but I didn't.
That's fine. I just want to know if you thought later on in your life, and you worked for many years, do you think that degree, not the degree, but the knowledge that you gained through those courses, those classes, did you use any of that?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I felt like taking what at the time, the fundamental classes in this program, it was a C-based curriculum. So you took 3 terms of C, which was a whole year. You took assembly language. That was fine. You took C++. Then you got to be exposed to a whole bunch of interesting languages, which were things like Ada and Forth and Fortran. Even though maybe your audience isn't using a lot of those languages now, every language brings with it its own metaphors and its own mindset. So, and then as we went on, we learned a little Python and Java and things like that. And what I realized was college is where fundamentally I learned to learn how to take on a new language and bring it in and learn it. So college, I don't use C very much now. I never used it very much professionally. But college is where I learned how to learn programming languages, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. And people have different ways of learning. Some people learn by reading books. Some people don't have the discipline needed for books, and they need in-person training, and some people go blog posts, and some people really learn in class environments. I'm one of those people. I love being in a classroom and having to interact with a knowledgeable teacher, and that helped me personally. So it's good to know that it's helped you. But a lot of people, they will say that when you go to college, yes, you learn the fundamentals. Yes, you learn the technology, but you don't learn best practices, for example. College, nobody writes unit tests, right?
Right, right.
So there, you don't know. You're not using a source control system, most probably. You're not learning how the world works. And so when you get your first job and you start working, this is a huge shock because you have the tools, kind of, but you have to retool yourself almost.
I think I would almost say it's more than almost. It's when an employer, and as somebody who hired dozens, if not 100, I was the primary hirer at this global company I worked at for 14 years, where we alluded to earlier, I had early struggles. We didn't expect people who we hired right out of college to know anything about version control software development lifecycle processes, they had had a junior project or maybe a senior project where they had to create a sizable piece of work, sometimes in a team. But the reality was, is we knew something they didn't. They thought their education had just ended. We realized their education had just begun. And so we fully expected over the next 1 to 2 years, their primary goal was going to be learning the systems, not even from a technical perspective, but from a practices, a habits, the software development cycles, no matter what methodology we used. All of these things we were going to teach them, because while they thought, yeah, I'm ready to come in and get started, we just kind of smiled and we would say, sure, well, let's get you started, and then put them on a 1 to 2 year training program where they would become not just a coder, but a professional software engineer. That's the way we thought.
That's interesting. A 1 to 2 year old, 1 to 2 year I said 2 year old, 1 to 2 year training program. I have not heard that before. This lengthy training program. What is it like?
Well, it was a bit informal at first, and at first it was really a matter of the managers in the department, the team leads, huddling up and saying, you know, the people we're hiring for college are really smart and really bright, but it takes 1 to 2 years before we can hand them a large piece of work and they know how to organize themselves. They've really become proficient with our internal process tools. They understand what's expected of their role versus the roles that sit maybe on either side of them, which might be business analysis and quality assurance. It wasn't that they didn't understand the technology. They couldn't write a good loop or they couldn't optimize an algorithm. It was that and a lot of times they lacked the professionalism. So they would come in late. They would dress inappropriately. They didn't know how to conduct themselves in meetings. They didn't, and maybe that sounds terrible, but there is a really important part of being a software professional, and that's the professional aspect. So it started with us as an internal organization realizing that we could hire raw talent right out of college, but we couldn't just throw them on a team and never talk to them again and assume they would just get it. What we had to do was really give them a structured 1 to 2 year plan. And so at first, people didn't even really know they were in training. They just knew that in the first year or two, they didn't get the same kind of projects that they got in years 2, 3, and 4 of their career. And over time, we formalized that into a training program that became more intentional. And it was the team lead's job, who was also the primary person doing interviewing and hiring, because they were going to have that person work for them. It was the team lead's job to make sure that person received the training they need and to partner them up with other people in the company who were at similar levels or possibly get them a mentor.
Okay, I want to ask you this question about your first couple of jobs in software development as a software developer. Because I think the first job you told me you got $8 an hour, that was probably not exactly software development. And then eventually you did get your first programming job. How did you get it?
The first one I got, it was an IT job. And so software development was a part of my job, in same as setting up a computer, fixing a printer. Small companies oftentimes will have one IT person. And so that's what I was. And this was a company of maybe like 60 people that was a nonprofit. So I was expected to split my time between fixing printers, setting up PCs, replacing mice and keyboard, troubleshooting the network, and writing and maintaining the student database system, which was written in FoxPro. So I do think software development was a part of my job, but it certainly wasn't all of it. After I left that job, I got a job at this global company that had an IT group, and it had a programming department, and it was small. I think I was the 8th person in that department. So I joined a group of people whose job was writing the software. And at the time, our job was not only that, but deploying the software, maintaining the servers, maintaining the databases, designing the database, delivering the software out to the manufacturing entities. Everything. If it had to do with the software, we were the team involved and everybody did everything on the team. So there was not a lot of specialization, which I think was really beneficial because we could pull in people as we needed to. That job, I think I started at $8.22 an hour at that job in 1996, which I thought was a pretty good deal at the time.
So now you're working and you're doing software development, you're doing other types of support work. Was it hard for you to be accepted as a valuable, productive member of, you know, your organization?
You know, I think I stood in my way about being accepted. For example, I had dropped out of school, as I mentioned. Everyone else there, many of the people had come from the same school and received bachelor's degrees. Then there was a group of people who were from India, who were very good at their jobs, that worked there. And they had all had masters. Some of them had doctorates. I don't feel that they were judgmental towards me as much as I was defensive and worried that I would not be accepted. They looked at me and said, if you have good ideas, if you work hard, if you're trainable, if you're humble, then we'll accept you. And I did. Those weren't those things weren't said overtly, but those are the values that I felt. And I got along great with everybody. But I always felt as though I had something to prove for the first 1 to 2 years. And this was a very informal department at the beginning. So we would get, I was getting projects of all sizes right from the get-go because there weren't really formal training programs. So yeah, I was really working hard to show myself that I was smart enough to be with this group. And honestly, at the time, and I think this still happens today in computer science and other engineering degrees. When you come out of school, you think it's all about your brain, your smarts. And it's the smarts that people compare. It's how great an algorithm can you write. There's really a sense of hierarchy based on who's smarter. At least that's just what I've seen. Really in organizations, especially in academia, maybe not even who's more productive, but if you're really smart, then that sort of we as a group of people called computer, you know, software engineers tend to really value intellect. And I always doubted my intellect, but I always sort of tried to make up for it with raw desire and sweat and just putting in the work. So that usually worked pretty well for me.
So your experiences have been very interesting because you started working at this company that we alluded to earlier and you're really, really struggling. And after a while, you stuck with it and you somehow managed to go over that. And then you stayed with that company. It's a very interesting story. And I want to talk a little bit about that. So was that your second, third job? Was it your first job? Which job was it?
It was my second job. It was my second job, yeah.
Okay, so how did you get that second job?
I got that job when I had been laid off from the first job, and a friend of mine who worked at this other company and I were chatting, and he said, well, you should come apply over here. And I said, well, I don't have a degree. And he said, well, I'll put in a good word for you. And I went to go do the interview. I didn't realize at the time, but when in the interview, they send you home with a box of about 25 books to read, that's a pretty good sign. And they did. And I went home and devoured them and then came back for my second interview and showed that I'd read them and was trying. It was really through a personal referral, though, that I got the second job.
So personal connections are really, really important.
Really important.
And everybody who's listening right now and wants to get their first, second, or third job, the best way to do that is get to know people in the industry or even outside the industry, because software development is one of those things where everybody, even unrelated industries, they need software developers. So it's good to know people. And the best way to know people is, what do you say, Marcus?
Well, for me at the time, it went back to college. So the people I knew were because I'd gone to school with them, because we were not only friends, but they respected that I did the work and I worked hard and all these other things. So if we kind of circle around, I think one of the benefits of going to college is you meet other people in your field. And I still have relationships with many of them, teachers, faculty, and students. And I've really benefited greatly from those relationships. These days, I think things might be a bit different, although I still think college is a great place to meet future peers. But obviously conferences, meetups, all kinds of places where you can rub shoulders with people and get to know them. Online communities, I believe, for me, have been a bit harder to form deep personal trust relationships with. And that's what you do in college. At least that's what I was able to do in college when you and somebody else are in the lab at, you know, midnight working on something and frustrated. You tend to get to know each other pretty well when you're kind of shoulder to shoulder like that.
All right, let's get back to your story, Marcus. You started this job, you got a referral, and you were hired as a programmer, I'm assuming.
Junior programmer, yes.
Junior programmer, excellent place to start because very few expectations, and you should be able to just walk in and hopefully ask questions and ask for guidance from anybody else, literally.
I did, yep. And it was in a programming language that I'd never used before. On a database I'd never used before. So I was absolutely free to ask questions. It was a great environment to learn in. And even after I made big mistakes, they just chalked that up to learning. And, you know, they were wise enough to only give me enough, the right size things to work on to really help me progress through it.
But you ran into trouble. Something happened that caused them to give you warnings. And what, just walk me through that. What happened?
Well, being a small IT department in a manufacturing company, one of the things we were tasked with was also doing phone support. So when a plant would call and had a problem with the ERP system, that's the enterprise resource planning system that we had built that ran the manufacturing plant, someone on the software team had to answer that. And I actually kind of liked it and enjoyed it. Not as much as programming, but it made me feel helpful and smart and rewarded to be the expert on the other end of the phone. So over a period of months, as I got to learn the system and I became more proficient in it, my phone would ring more and more because plant folks would realize that, hey, here's an energetic young guy at the other end of the line who doesn't mind answering their questions and really wants to help. So over time, all that phone time really killed my productivity. And I happened to be assigned to a large project. It was my first really complicated project that was going to take about 3 months, it was estimated. And I hadn't been entirely honest with my boss about how I was using my time because he didn't really realize how much time I was spending on help desk items. That's what we called those. Over time, that project started to languish, the large one, and it was because I was spending so much time helping the plant. My boss told me on numerous occasions to stop because at that point, we actually had a help desk person and it would be their job. And I was to just simply refer calls over to that other person. I didn't think that other person did a very good job. So secretly, I just kept taking the calls and being helpful. And then I started staying late, putting in overtime to get this other project done. Well, when your phone rings once or twice an hour, it really kills your concentration, your flow time when you're trying to think about a hard problem. So that also really destroyed my ability to think deeply about this large project I was given. And 3 months came around and I really hadn't made any progress at all. And at that point, I couldn't hide it anymore. So when my boss decided that we needed to really talk about this, and he told me in no uncertain terms, you need to stop doing what you're doing and focus on the work in front of you. And after this project, if you still love being on the phone more than programming, we'll just move you over to help desk, which I didn't like that at all because I wanted to be an engineer. I just also really like to help people. The reality was I really developed a crummy attitude about that time. I felt like my boss was being unappreciative of me. I wanted to be helpful and I thought, doggone it, I should be able to do both. So I got a bad attitude, kind of got a hard heart towards him. And as he would discipline me and he would say, you need to stop and focus on this other thing, I would always tell him with my mouth, yep, I'm going to do that. But when the moment came, I just couldn't not pick up the phone and be helpful. Well, it didn't take long before he realized that his informal attempts at correction weren't helping me. And so we had a correction event where I got a written warning, called into his boss's office, and we talked about things. I think it was a verbal warning, which is weird because they still write it down on a piece of paper and make you sign it. long and short of it is, I would love to sit here and say that that really broke the, that somehow got through to me, but it didn't. And we had to go another 2 weeks until I got a written warning. And by then I was just really frustrated. I really was thinking that, you know, my boss and upper management was unfair and maybe I should start complaining about him. And I just thought I was being abused, which is a crazy thing to think in hindsight. But it frankly got so bad that finally on the second warning, my boss and his boss sat down with me and they said, look, here's the employee handbook. You know that if you get a third written warning, it's an automatic termination. You're now 2 weeks from that. We don't understand why you won't change your behavior. You tell us you're going to do something. You do another thing. It doesn't seem like you really want to even be in the position you're in, but we know you can do the job. So it looks to us like in 2 weeks, we're going to meet and fire you. Here's a piece of paper that says that. In the next 2 weeks, if we don't see things radically change with your attitude and behavior, we'll just fire you and you will have really quit at that point because we've given you every opportunity. But in the meantime, at the end of every day, you have to fill out a timesheet and take it down to your boss's cube and you have to review it with him. And if at any time he looks at your timesheet and feels it isn't honest, or he feels that you haven't been working on the right things, he'll just let you go right then. And we'll just call that a termination for cause because we have bent over backwards to try and get through to you. I signed the piece of paper and I left and I went out to my car. And at that point, it was like it finally hit me. I was going to lose my job. I had 3 kids at home and a wife, and I was the sole breadwinner. We live far away from family. In a small town, there weren't other jobs to be had. This was literally the only programming job in our town. And I just kind of broke down. And I realized at that point that I didn't want to lose this job. I had been very arrogant. I had a bad attitude. I was hard-hearted. And I wanted to change. And kind of composed myself, went in, finished out the rest of my day. And honestly, came back in the next day with an entirely new attitude. I had had a mindset shift. Whenever somebody stopped me in the hall and wanted to chat, nope, I'm busy. I have work to do. When my phone rang and people would say, hey, can you help us with this problem? Nope, you need to call the help desk. I'll transfer you now. Click. And every day I had to fill out a timesheet and do what I call the corporate walk of shame, taking it down to my boss, the cubicle at the end of the hallway, knock on his door, sit in front of him, and subject myself to his authority to walk through that and wonder if today I had done a good enough job to keep my job. 2 weeks went by, and I had. Everything wasn't great, but they said, wow, we have noticed an improvement. And I thought, oh, good. They're going to just say it's all over, and I can go back to normal. But they wisely did. They said, let's try it for another 2 weeks. Same thing. Okay, I did it for another 2 weeks. Then they said, we're going on a month. This is pretty good. Let's do it for one more month. Did it for another whole month. At that point, they said, all right, it's been 2 months and it appears that you're being consistent and you really have a change of heart. You've made really good progress on this project and it's coming along well and it's provable. And so we'll take you off of this very short leash that we've put you on. And we'll put you on a regular probation where you'll just meet with your boss once a week like normal. For the next 3 months, you'll be on probation. Well, 3 months went by and I continued to really apply myself and do well. And I was off probation. And about 8 months later, when my boss was promoted, my team lead was promoted to department manager, I was completely shocked that I was the person that he picked to take his job. Completely shocked. But he did, and I just sort of was able to move up from there in the organization. But it made me realize that the value of correction is, the goal of correction is to change behavior. It's to give someone a chance to have a mindset and an emotional shift. It's not just about going through, filling out forms or kind of going through the motions. So needless to say, as somebody whose life was changed because of an employee correction process, I'm a darn big fan of employee correction processes and formal processes like that because I know that they work and they worked for me.
Yeah, what an incredible story. And I think I like what I like about this is that your bosses certainly had empathy towards you. Because a lot of companies, what they would do is they would hold grudges and hold this internal evaluation. And then at the time of your yearly evaluation or some other random time, they would just fire you because you can. Because in America and in some other countries, you're not obligated as a company to give any notices. You can just let people go unless, I don't know, maybe it's different in your case.
It's not. No, they absolutely could have. And I think you're right. Not only did they have empathy, but as I matured and began managing people, man, I realized how much time it took them. Like to meet with somebody at the end of every shift, to go through a timesheet, to be so consistent and fair. I mean, they were absolutely fair in a way that blew me away, that I'd never had a boss who was so fair and just with me. And that meant being honest about the good and the bad. And so, yeah, you're right. I think they did have empathy and they really wanted me to improve, but they were not willing to just change the rules for me, if that makes sense. They didn't want it in an emotional way, like we want to be your friend. And so we'll do whatever it takes to have you stay. They wanted it in a way that was, we want you to fit in here and we think you can do great work, but you have to do the work and make that decision.
It must have been incredibly hard for you to go through that. As I was listening to you talk about the process, I can imagine the drain, the emotional drain you must have felt. So you have seen yourself go through these strains, but I'm sure that you've seen others. Now, do you think that we are doing a good job as an industry of dealing with people coming in, and a whole lot of them are going through these issues? For it could be psychological issues, emotional issues, it could be technical issues, it could be personality issues. A lot of them, like yourself in the past, were actually good workers. They have good ability, but they have maybe trouble fitting in, and maybe just you know, changing themselves in a way to be productive, or maybe affecting change. There's lots of things that are going on in our minds, and lots of things going on in boardroom meetings and so on. Do you think as an industry, we're doing a good job of bringing people on board and just making them comfortable? Or on the flip side, you think a lot of new people are struggling like yourself? You think you were a one-off case?
I think we're better than maybe we were 20 years ago. But to be honest, I think there, as Bruce Tolgan, one of my favorite authors, likes to write, there's really an under-management epidemic occurring in a lot of different knowledge worker circles. And I see it terribly, terribly in software engineering. And I see it because the people who lead software engineering groups usually think that it's their technical skills that need to stay sharp, that it's their architecture or software code review or agile process skills that they really have to improve to manage people, when it's not. It's really their human relationship skills, their ability to give clear feedback, the courage it takes to have crucial conversations when the stakes are high. These sorts of interpersonal skills aren't nearly valued enough by our industry. And so, unfortunately, I think there's a lot of programmers who are blindsided when they find out their boss doesn't think they're doing a good job. Maybe that's at an annual evaluation. Maybe it's the day they get fired. Maybe it's the day they thought they were going to get a raise and the raise is much smaller. And I also think that we have a lot of team leads that get promoted who are asked to do two jobs. They're asked to still be a contributing software engineer on the team and to manage this group of six people. And by the way, management is just an overhead. So try and minimize that. Where you're really valuable is in software engineering. And I think that's a pretty wrong and bad and devastatingly horrible way to approach leadership. So I think as an industry, we've got some player coach titles. And I call the team lead one a player coach because it's almost like, you know, 50 years ago, you'd find somebody in the basketball, in the NBA, And like they would say, well, we don't have money for a coach, so why don't we just take our best player and we'll make him be the coach and he has to play half the game. Nobody does that anymore in sports. And that's because the metaphor, the paradigm doesn't work. But in software engineering, we still think that the player coach role is really a great role for people. But I think it leads to poor performance during the game and really poor performance when coaching. And I was just talking with a guy the other day who said to me, you know, I've been in this bifurcated player coach role so long. I'm the CTO now, and I'm not even a great coder anymore, but I certainly have never really developed the people and leadership skills necessary to lead this organization. And it makes me feel like maybe the people who created these roles were trying to optimize for the wrong thing. Maybe they were trying to minimize this management overhead and still just get as much code written as possible. So yeah, I think there is really an epidemic of poor managers in software engineering.
Yeah, that is so true. Management is hard. The problem is we are always, in a lot of organizations, we're always trying to cut costs.
So right.
One way of doing that is to hire a bunch of junior developers. And so the idea is that if you have two junior developers, maybe for the cost of one senior developer, then you get, if not twice as much work done, then 1.5 times as much work done, which is a complete fallacy, right?
Right. You can get a lot of wrong work done. And then what I actually see on top of that is then you'll hire one senior developer and you'll say, now you lead these four junior people and you need to write all this code as well.
Right. And that's one of the problems we run into when we're trying to do institute mentorship into an organization. Well, these two senior people, they are going to now be mentors for any juniors that come in. However, they still have to do 8 hours a day of this work that they're supposed to do. And this is not part of their evaluation. They're not getting any raises out of that. Now, every time a junior person that needs mentorship, that needs some kind of guidance, approaches them, now it's encroaching on their time. Instead of spending time with their family, now they're going to be sitting and helping somebody else. So if you really want this idea of helping other people in an organization, we will then, in that case, we would go ahead and give them compensate them for that or account for that time. All right, so we're coming to the end of this episode. What's the best advice you can give to software shops looking to hire new developers?
I think creating a structured onboarding process. I love the idea of assigning a mentor. I think that mentor needs to be a formal role or a formal part of their role, where you expect less code to be delivered by them because you actually take time. They're going to be expected to take time with those new folks. And I think just really having weekly one-on-one meetings where with each developer, where you create deep, trusted, bi-directional relationships with them. You need their feedback to create the kind of environment that they're going to thrive in. And they need feedback from you every day to improve. So don't ignore them. Don't set them in the corner and just assume that they'll figure it all out. Get down and really interact with them.
And quickly, what's your best advice for people wanting to be developers or new developers?
It's a great career. I love software development. Don't think that, just keep practicing. Just keep trying. Yes, there's a lot of people out there that are better than you. There's a lot of people out there better than me. But try and go start with the fundamentals. Learn hard things, because a lot of it is really hard things. And just build your way up. But be consistent. Write little programs every day. Try every day to learn something new. And don't be distracted by the new flashy, fancy stuff all the time. I think starting with C, even if you're going to be a web developer, is a great place to start, because it forces you to learn pointer math and a lot of internals that web languages just abstract away from you, but in the end, become really important for your career.
It was really inspirational for me to hear about your story and how you struggled and how you overcame your struggles. So I think this is going to be a fantastic interview. Before we wrap up, I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about some of the things you're doing right now. I know you have a service that you offer. And what are you working on these days?
I have a mailing list where I'm doing a lot of writing. And so I encourage folks, if you're interested in leading developers or maybe someday hope to, sign up for my list at marcusblankenship.com. I have a free 5-day Become a Better Manager crash course that I've recently been revamping. And so it's out there as well. And I do workshops from time to time. So I announce those to my list. And I've got something I'm working on for later this year that I'm not ready to reveal. But it's kind of the culmination of the last year's worth of work and thought. So when the time is right, I'll let you know.
Great. All of that information, all those links will be in the show notes. Go check it out. And once again, I want to thank Marcus. Check out Marcus's website and sign up for his mailing list if you're interested in becoming a manager. Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the show. You can read the highlights and show notes with links on mentoringdevelopers.com/episode and the number of the episode. For example, mentoringdevelopers.com/episode 10 or /episode 25 and so on. Let me know what you think about this episode. If you'd like to ask a question or if you have a comment, you can email me at us@mentoringdevelopers.com. Oh, and one more thing. I really want you to be part of the show, even if you are a little shy. So go ahead and type mentoringdevelopers.com/join in your web browser. This will open a Google form where you can tell me what topics interest you and what dates and times you're available for about an hour or so. Everyone is welcome, and I would be thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you at mentoringdevelopers.com/join.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.